Amidst the heroism of the American Revolution and the glorious language of the Declaration of Independence, the moral stain of slavery is often relegated to the historical background. Though George Washington and Thomas Jefferson were among the many important figures of that era who owned slaves, the Founding Fathers are often given a pass on this issue. Yet both of these giants owe substantial parts of their political or personal fortunes to slavery. As president, both worked to perpetuate it in matters as diverse as the location of the nation's capital and the Louisiana Purchase. Today we'll talk with two historians whose new books focus on the influence of slavery in the early years of the American Republic. Later in the program, a look at the post-Shevard Nadza future in the Republic of Georgia, and your letters on the flu and on big-time pond hockey. But first, the Founding Fathers and slavery. If you have questions about Washington and Jefferson, what they did to preserve and expand the slave system, and how they justified it, give us a phone call. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is totn@npr.org. Gary Wills joins us from Evanston, Illinois. His new book is Negro President, Jefferson and the Slave Power. And Gary Wills, good of you to join us today.
Glad to be here.
And Henry Winsick joins us from Charlottesville, Virginia. He's the author of An Imperfect God, George Washington, His Slaves and the Creation of America. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you, Neil. It's great to be here.
Henry, part of your book is about how George Washington acted as a slave master, and maybe on one incident, and no more, one incident is particularly telling. That's the story of how, as a young man, he helped Virginia planters pay off some debts by setting up a lottery.
That's right. I was quite startled when I found that. I came across it almost by accident. I was reading through the old issues of the Virginia Gazette from 1768 and 69, just to get a sense of what Washington would have done when he visited the town of Williamsburg when the assembly was in session. And almost immediately I came across this advertisement for a raffle of slave families and slave children, and Washington was one of the managers of it. It was quite startling.
Raffling off slaves to pay off somebody's debts. People.
That's right. I mean, I had always known that slaves could be sold at auction, but I had never. This raffle was a gambling game because one of the biggest planters in Virginia had gone bankrupt. The economy was in a depression. Nobody had a lot of money to lay down a lot of money in an auction. But they figured that if you turned this sale into a gambling game, that the money would roll. And in fact, it did. And, you know, the prizes in this ad said specifically that slaves were prizes. And some of these prizes were children. And this really startled me to see that first of all, that this sort of thing happened. And second of all, that George Washington himself was one of the organizers. He got involved because the man who had gone bankrupt owed a very large debt to Martha Washington's family. Mm-hmm. And so George stepped in to collect that debt.
I see. Now, we heard a clip of tape at the beginning of the program from an earlier interview you did on Fresh Air with Terry Gross. And that seemed to paint a picture of Washington as a pretty stern taskmaster.
He was always concerned primarily with economic efficiency. He routinely separated husbands and wives on his plantations. If he had use for the skilled men at the main house, and their wives and children were sent to the outlying plantations where they did sort of the scut work of the farms. And they rarely got a chance to see each other. You know, maybe on Sunday they could get together. But the clothing was very poor. The food rations were minimal. The housing was just terrible. I mean, Washington himself said that in order to move a slave house, you could just pick it up and put it on a cart, and you might not even need the cart. They were that flimsy. So conditions were really quite poor and never improved, even though Washington eventually decided to free his slaves.
And you get to that epiphany over a long period of time, but at least in part, you attribute that to the character of the African-American troops who served with General Washington during the Revolution.
I think that may have been part of it. I think Washington was impressed with the loyalty and the bravery and the personal devotion to him that many black troops showed during the Revolution. In the last summer of the war, when Washington was facing a very serious manpower shortage, a German officer visited his camp outside of New York and found that about 25% of Washington's army was black, which was a statistic that astonished me, and that the best unit in Washington's army was a majority black unit. It was 75% black. It was the 1st Rhode Island Regiment.
Indeed, you say he commanded an army more integrated than any American army would be until Vietnam.
That's right. There was a very strong African American presence, certainly in the Civil War, and in World War I and World War II. But the blacks were very carefully kept into segregated combat units, or largely into in segregated labor units. But in Washington's army, the black men were spread throughout the army.
But that one report about 25% in that one. Any way to verify those numbers?
Well, it was a firsthand eyewitness account. From 1781, we don't really have very good other records, but from 1778, there are excellent records. And one historian, Phil Morgan, estimates that in 1778, the black presence in the army was as high as 16%.
Gary Wills, let's bring you into the conversation. The one point in your book where George Washington plays a role and a previously, at least not been known to me, is the role that you see him playing in the location of the nation's capital, from where I'm speaking to you right now.
That's right. The three important Virginians, Washington and Jefferson and Madison, teamed up to make sure that the whole management of the placement of the capital was put in Washington's hands. And he was commissioned by Congress to survey 10 square miles above a certain line on the Potomac. He deliberately went down below that line to include the city of Alexandria, part of the district until 1846, when it was ceded back to Virginia. He wanted a slaveholding capital because they had had endless trouble in Philadelphia. When the slaveholders went there with their personal slaves, slaves escaped. They were induced to escape. They were encouraged. They were used to assault the dignity of their owners. That was an abolitionist state at the time. In fact, if you went through, you could keep your slaves only as a transient, which meant if you stayed long enough, 6 months was the absolute cutoff, the slaves were free. So Washington had to shuttle his slaves back to Mount Vernon before the six-month period came due. So they were very aware that it's hard to have the majesty of the government upheld when you are being assailed by people because you own other people. And so it was urgent for them to get the capital into slave territory.
You write, Washington was placed where a diverse cultural life would pose no challenge to its sleepy southern folkways, no professors from a major university, no benevolent Quaker merchants, no sophisticated financial operatives would rub up against the Maryland and Virginia slaveholding natives, no major harbor would give a cosmopolitan air to the place, and describe in the first half of its 19th century, its hick town atmosphere.
That's right. And that's why there could be 12 of our presidents who were slaveholders. Over a quarter of our presidents owned slaves. That could never have happened in Philadelphia. It only happened because they had brought it back where that was accepted. So for decade after decade, the White House was serviced by slaves.
Let's get to some callers. Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and the email address is totn@npr.org. And let's begin with Gary, who's with us from Memphis, Tennessee.
Hey, Neil, great show.
Thank you.
My question is a broader historical context with Washington and Jefferson owned slaves. In other words, was slavery prevalent throughout the Western Hemisphere, both in Europe, North and South, and even the Caribbean at that time?
Henry Winsick, I'm not sure you caught all of that, but how prevalent was slavery at that time when you were writing about?
Well, people often make the statement that the founders who held slaves were just the heirs of thousands of years of tradition, which is actually not true, because earlier forms of slavery, came about when people were conquered in war, they could be made slaves, but they could also be ransomed. And you didn't have this perpetual mother to daughter, daughter to daughter, race-based slavery that we had in the New World. And certainly it existed in the West Indies and in South America. But as I point out in my book, it had rather recently been established in Virginia when George Washington was born. They didn't regard themselves as the heirs of a very, very old tradition. They had to devise a legal system and a social system to accommodate slavery, which was changing right before their eyes. And there was even some doubt as to who was a slave and who could be free and the manner in which people could be enslaved. So it's a much more complicated issue than that.
May I ask, how did Abraham Lincoln of his generation view Washington and Jefferson on this issue?
Gary Wills?
Well, Lincoln, in a sense, stole the Declaration of Independence. He said all men are created equal meant that blacks are equal. That's not what Jefferson had in mind. He had in mind homo politicus, those who are capable of self-government. And he excluded from that women and children and the mad and slaves. But by Lincoln's time, an egalitarian reading of the Declaration was arising, and he gave it his authority. It was an extension. It was a kind of loose construction of the Declaration. So he wanted to downplay Jefferson's attitude towards slavery. I don't recall that he ever talked about Washington's. Of course, he had read Parson Weems and other things that glorified Washington, but Washington was not as important in his worldview as Jefferson was.
Interesting, Gary Wills, about Gary's earlier question about slavery in the Western Hemisphere, and one of the fascinating chapters in your book is about how Thomas Jefferson, before he was president and then after he became president, reacted to the second revolution in the Americas, that in Haiti.
That's right. Toussaint Louverture, the great black leader, led a revolution in Saint-Domingue, as Haiti was called then. And his predecessor, John Adams, gave aid to that revolution. And Timothy Pickering, the Secretary of State, sent the United States Navy down to help Toussaint. After all, this was the heir to our revolution. But when Jefferson came into power within a year and a half, he instantly cut off diplomatic recognition to Toussaint, and told Napoleon's emissary that if he wished to crush Toussaint, America would help him. We would starve him out.
And this eventually resulted in the fact that, I guess, Haiti was never recognized by the American government until Lincoln's time.
That's right. All that period before the Civil War, when the South really controlled American politics, there was not only not recognition, there was a fight against recognizing anybody as the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee who didn't give a kind of loyalty pledge that there would be no recognition of Haiti.
Henry Winsick, take us back for a moment, if you will, to that image that I guess we all have in our minds of Mount Vernon, the George Washington's famous estate on the Potomac. Tell us a little bit about the greenhouse at Mount Vernon as you describe it. It's a pretty striking image.
Yes, the greenhouse is one of the most prominent buildings on the grounds of Mount Vernon, and it's a building. It was completed in the early 1790s, and Washington had begun to conceive such a building as early as the 1770s, but the revolution delayed its construction. But I had spent many visits walking around the garden and admiring the greenhouse, and it wasn't until I had visited it about six or eight times that I suddenly realized that the wings of the greenhouse, which have just small windows facing out to the garden, were actually the slave quarters. And Washington had done an amazing thing. I mean, he had devised an architecture that rendered slavery invisible, while also sort of weaving it into the overall architectural scheme of Mount Vernon. It was quite a chilling stroke of architectural genius. He placed the doorways on the for the slave quarters on the other side, on the work side of the greenhouse. So when visitors strolled with Washington or by themselves through the formal gardens, they would not have realized that they're walking past the slave housing.
We're talking about how slavery was woven into the fabric of this country from very early on. We're taking your calls, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. You can send us email as well, TOTN@npr.org. Back after the break, I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing slavery's role in the lives of two presidents, Join the discussion. What are your questions about the economic and cultural role that slavery played during this country's formative years? Our number, 800-989-8255. The email address is totn@npr.org. Our guests are Henry Wincik. He's the author of An Imperfect God, George Washington, His Slaves, and the Creation of America. And Gary Wills, the author most recently of Negro President Jefferson and the Slave Power. And let's get another caller on the line. This is Robert, who's with us from Salt Lake City in Utah.
Yes, Neil, great program. I just wanted to make an observation and then listen to your guest response. Jefferson had decided early on that slavery was such a divisive issue that there's no way that they could forge an economic and a political union and take that issue on as well. As we look at the fact that the union was established, don't we have to say that in hindsight it was a great first step?
All right. I'm not sure who wants to tackle that question. Henry Wincik, why don't you go first?
Oh, I was hoping you would go, Gary.
I bet you were.
But the caller is absolutely right. The issue of slavery began to show itself as a wedge issue as early as the Revolutionary War. When a plan was proposed to emancipate any slaves from Georgia and South Carolina who would fight for the American cause, and the legislatures of those two states vehemently opposed it, and then later on at the Constitutional Convention, slavery was the source of a tremendous argument, and those two Southern states said that they would never join the Union if they didn't get everything they wanted in terms of slavery. And in George Washington's mind, The preeminent issue was the creation of a strong and lasting union. I mean, he said, I can foresee no evil greater than disunion. So for a time, he was willing to put slavery to make the issue of union more important than that of slavery. But later on, he said that the union would not survive if slavery were allowed to continue.
Gary Wills.
Well, yes, it was the bargain that we struck in order to have a union, but it was a devil's bargain, and of course, rather than being ameliorated, as some hoped, it got worse and worse. In order to have the South come in, we had to count 3/5 of the slave population as part of the representation in Congress. This gave a tremendous edge to the South. They always had 1/3 more seats in Congress than they deserved by their white population. And their vote there determined many issues, whether slavery would go into Missouri, into Kansas and Nebraska, into the conquered territories of Mexico, determined the gag rule that they couldn't even discuss slavery in the Congress. It determined Jefferson's election. He won only because he had 12 votes because of that 3/5 count of the slave population. So it turned, in effect, the whole government over to the South, and the extension of slavery and the deepening of slavery went on and on, despite every effort at compromise, every effort at abolition or partial amelioration, and so only war could finally settle that issue. So it was a terrible bargain. It was not a good bargain.
My observation would still be, at least there was a union 80 years later to deal with it. There wouldn't have been a union had that been tackled in the beginning.
And it had 80 years of terrible, terrible oppression and cruelty
and
corruption of the owners.
I agree with that, but I still think the union is born because that issue wasn't addressed. Divisive as it was, the union would have never been born.
Robert, thanks very much for the phone call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. One of the things you point out in your book, Gary Wills, is that there were at least a nascent organizational efforts towards secession by the North over exactly this issue.
That's right. It began with the Louisiana Purchase. The people in the North said, we don't mind buying that territory. It's a great bargain. But we don't want you to extend slavery into it, or if you are going to extend slavery into it, you should not extend the 3/5 count of slaves into it, because that will give much greater power to the South. Or if you won't do either of those two things, you should amend the Constitution and take out the 3/5 clause. The 3/5 clause was originally an attempt to strike some kind of balance between the original 13 states. And now, with slavery growing into Louisiana, the Floridas, Missouri, California, the thing made no sense. It was a cruel bargain. You know, it meant A northerner who had one vote for Congress had to face a plantation owner in the South who had, let's say, if he had 50 slaves, he had 30 extra votes. He had 31 votes. If he had 200 slaves, he had 120 votes, and so on. It was an absurd situation, and it shows how desperate they were to form the Union and what power they turned over the South in order to do it.
Here's an email question we have from Jane Pelling in Portland, Oregon. I've heard that it was Martha's family that really drove the Washingtons to own slaves, and that when George Washington died, Martha was unaware that his will released all their slaves except for a few of Martha's personal slaves. Is it true that he struggled with this issue on a very personal level? And I guess, Henry Winsick, that's to you.
Yes, the majority of the slaves at Mount Vernon belonged not to Martha herself, but to her family collectively. They belonged to the Custis estate. You see, Martha had been married before she was married to George Washington. She had been married to a man named Daniel Parke Custis, who died very suddenly, leaving her with two small children and an estate worth about £40,000 in land, slaves, and cash. And that was the dowry that attracted the eye of George Washington. And that was the great fortune that Martha brought to Mount Vernon, which allowed George Washington to become a pretty large scale planter, to expand Mount Vernon, and it gave him the leisure to indulge in political activities. But later on, as George Washington turned against slavery, he ran up against the stubbornness of Martha's relatives and Martha herself, who viewed the slaves as an indispensable source of wealth, which would ensure the status of their family. And it got to the point where one of Martha's heirs was actually selling young girls on the open auction market in Washington, D.C. in 1796. And Washington apparently found out about this and tried to halt the slaves, and launched a very elaborate campaign to try to find a way to free all of his own slaves at Mount Vernon, the 123 slaves that he owned, as well as the 153 slaves owned by Martha's family. But we don't know exactly why the plan failed, but my speculation is my assumption is that it was Martha's family who just dug in and said, we're not going to give these people up, they're too valuable. So there was a great divergence of opinion.
And Gary Wills, that prompts me to ask one of the prescient things that some people say about Thomas Jefferson. You spoke about the Louisiana Purchase before, and part of what he did was he refused to allow the importation of foreign slaves into Louisiana, which, again, in retrospect, looks pretty good, but you say he may have had another motive.
He definitely did. The South was against the importation of slaves at various times and in various parts because it drove down the price of slaves. Virginia and Kentucky especially had a surplus of slaves and had depleting soil, and therefore they wanted to keep the market for themselves, and that's why they said Louisiana can't have any foreign importations, and then they sold their own. Jefferson himself sold 85 slaves, and the price of those was held up by the fact that they had cut out foreign competition.
And again, that seems to undercut the, maybe we're just reading this through rose-colored glasses, but the idea that these were great men who had some benevolence and tried to keep families together, and that this was not quite the as horrible an enterprise as you're painting it, as breeding
no.
for sales.
It was horrible. After all, you know, they try to compare it with workers elsewhere, peasants in Europe or factory workers in the North. But slavery is an entirely different situation. You cannot compel a slave who wants to malinger, say he's sick or has some kind of injury to his leg or something, with wages. And so there are only two ways to compel the malingerer, and that's to whip them, which was done regularly on every plantation. Henry rightly says that Washington did, Jefferson's overseers did, or to bribe them. You bribe them in various ways, giving them special favors, giving them a tot of rum at the end of the day, giving them some special clothes or pieces of china. But you can't not compare it to free labor. And what it all comes down to eventually is coercion. And, of course, it corrupts the owner, and Jefferson himself said that. It coarsens them. It's a a situation of in which there can be no pleasant paternalistic family picture, as has been painted in the past. And it's reached absurd lengths. For instance, it was commonly said and very widely believed when I was first going to Monticello 40 years ago that when Jefferson came back from Washington, he was so beloved by his slaves that they took the horses out of the traces of his chariot and pulled him up the mountain on their own. That's all made up. You know, it's just wishful thinking. It's part of the fact that the situation was so horrible, people had to look away, had to play it down, had to hide it, as Henry says, hide the slave quarters, had to hide it from themselves. A lot of Jefferson's praise of agrarian virtue is a way of saying, well, we have slaves, but we have this wonderful yeoman farmer on the land, which is better than cities and banks and credit and commerce and trade and all those evil things they have in the North. That was a good way of saying to himself, this is bad, but I can live with it because there is some other bad things too. But of course, it was phony. The whole agrarian virtue myth was of the independent free yeoman on his own land. And Jefferson was defending a system in which owners, capitalists, agrarian capitalists, had a slave workforce of hundreds of people.
Let's get another caller in. This is Alexander, who's with us from Kalamazoo.
Greetings. Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Much respect to the two authors there as well. My last name is Washington. I'm an African-American, and it's no mystery in our family where our name comes from. The atrocities of slavery, the brutality, it has a long effect on our country. And for me, living with this truth, I kind of had to forgive Washington and the founding presidents in order to love myself so I can love my European family, so to speak. But this is the truth that the people need to hear, because this is what this country was founded on.
Henry,
I think that's wonderful to say. It's true. We have to love the people who we are connected with, who did give us many good things, even though we can see all their flaws. And it's very like the attitude we have to have as we grow up. We begin admiring our parents as kind of all-powerful and all-knowing, and as we grow up, we find out they're not so great. But nonetheless, we esteem them and honor them. And I think the same thing has to be done with the founders.
Mm-hmm. Henry?
I agree with that. And I think that the reality of slavery was so bad that it had to be hidden for two centuries. And it's just now coming out. But the odd thing is that the truth of slavery was known to many African Americans because they passed down stories of slave sales in harsh conditions, and you know, the separation of families in their oral history. So they knew what went on, but it was white people who couldn't face it, who didn't want to hear it, especially if it involved the founding fathers who were supposed to be sainted.
Exactly. But thank you so much.
Thank you for calling, Alexander.
Thank you.
Peace.
We're speaking with historians Henry Wincik and Gary Wills about the founding fathers and slavery. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller in. Matthew's with us from St. Louis.
Hi, I enjoyed the show. I was just calling to ask about American relationships with France and how our founding fathers were close to many French people of the time, and how the French viewed slavery among Americans, especially the enlightened founding fathers.
Gary Wills, Thomas Jefferson was there in France for quite a while and took some of his slaves with him.
That's right, and the French did free the slaves after the French Revolution. Napoleon later on reimposed slavery, but they did free the slaves in the Caribbean and elsewhere in their empire, and they looked with great disfavor on what was going on in America, and most Americans tried to explain or assuage and say we're doing something about it. And the most notable is Jefferson, who wrote the Notes on the State of Virginia, addressed largely to the French at the time of the Revolution. And he said, we have a plan to get rid of slavery. We can't live with them when they're freed because the accumulated grievances are so great there would be a bloodbath. But we will raise children to be free, take them away from their parents, and send them to a different country. The plan had all kinds of flaws. It was very impractical, and nothing ever came of it. And he never introduced it as a proposal before the Virginia legislature. But this was the story he told the French, to say, put up with us for a while and we'll solve this. But even there, even in those notes, he makes no bones about the fact that he considers blacks inferior. And we must remember, the French themselves were racists even when they were opposed to slavery, and many of the abolitionists were racists even when they were opposed to slavery. It's one thing to say you shouldn't own a person. It's another thing to say that person should be your equal, should vote, should be able to intermarry, and things of that sort. So the French had a kind of sympathy with the racist side, but not the slavery side.
And Henry Wincick, isn't it fair to say that even some of the abolitionists regarded slavery as a, well, as an evil, but a necessity, an economic necessity, as the country was being developed?
Well, the abolitionists thought that?
Mm-hmm. Or at least Northerners, anyway.
Well, actually, the Northerners realized, the people from New England especially knew the great fortunes that were being piled up from shipping the goods produced in the South. Shipping the cotton produced in the South to England, and they were all deeply involved in financing the economy that was based on slavery. But to go back to the caller's remarks about France, the greatest French hero of the American Revolution, the Marquis de Lafayette, was very much against slavery. And in the same letter he wrote to George Washington announcing the signing of the peace treaty with the British, he said, well, now we've gotten this done, it is now the time to begin freeing the slaves. And my dear general, the place to start is at Mount Vernon. And he proposed to Washington that they go in together and buy some land in Western Virginia and settle the slaves there and train them to become farmers and become independent and then let them go. And Washington delayed and delayed and delayed. He didn't go along with it. And Lafayette said many times over that he hated slavery. And in fact, he had a conversation with Jefferson on this subject, which was overheard by one of Jefferson's slaves and later recorded. I think it was 1824, Lafayette's tour through America. He rode with Jefferson in the carriage and says, "When are you going to free the slaves?" And Jefferson said, "Well, not now, but someday."
Someday. Thanks very much for the call, Matthew.
Thank you.
We're going to continue this conversation after a short break. Here are some of the stories NPR News is working on this afternoon. Senators have voted to cut off debate on a sweeping Medicare bill that would provide a prescription drug benefit for seniors. Opponents plan one more attempt to block it from passage. And jurors in Virginia decided today that John Allen Muhammad should receive the death penalty for the deadly Washington, D.C. area sniper attacks. The jury deliberated for 5 hours over 2 days to reach this morning's sentence verdict. You can hear details on both those stories later today on All Things Considered. As I said, when we come back on Talk of the Nation, we'll finish this conversation about how slavery shaped America, and we'll look at what's ahead for the Republic of Georgia, and we'll read from your letters. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Tomorrow, we'll talk about how rising health care costs affect labor negotiations and workers' wallets. That's tomorrow on Talk of the Nation. Today, we're talking with two historians about books which examine the complex role that slavery played in the lives of George Washington and Thomas Jefferson and how it helped shape America. Our number in Washington, if you'd like to join the conversation, is 800-989-8255, and the email address is totn@npr.org. Our guests are Henry Wincick, he's the author of An Imperfect God, and Gary Wills, who's the author of The Negro President. And here's an email question we got from Charles Kenny at the University of Oklahoma, and it's to you, Gary Wills. He writes, "You argued in Inventing America, 1978, that Jefferson was a follower of Scottish philosophers who thought slavery was wrong and argued that there is that in important respects Jefferson thought that Africans were created equal. We are also familiar with Jefferson's denunciation of slavery in the original draft of the Declaration of Independence that appears to be based on the claim that all men are created equal. Why do you now say that he excluded slaves from the Declaration, all men are created equal?"
Well, first of all, he did think that the slaves had an equal moral sense, which was the highest faculty in Scottish thinking. On the other hand, he did not think they were equal in intellect or beauty or aesthetic sense, which are very important to him. And the business that he denounced slavery in the Declaration is absolutely wrong. What he denounced was the slave trade, and as I've already said earlier, that was quite a different thing from slavery. What happened was that Virginia had outlawed the slave trade even before the Revolution, and the king vetoed that. Virginia was not acting out of altruism. It was acting out of self-interest. So that was removed from the Declaration because the Northerners realized it was hypocritical.
Let's get another caller in. David's with us from Morganton, North Carolina.
Hi. Thank you for taking the call. One of the speakers talked about a devil's bargain that was made in the Constitution, and I wanted to hear a little bit more about that, particularly as it plays out throughout the century in the life of the Republic.
Henry Wincick, I think that was you.
Washington said that nothing but the rooting out of slavery will preserve the Union. The bargain that they struck at the Constitution, that to keep slavery, it was apparent to many of them that it would eventually destroy the country. George Mason said that slavery brings down the judgment of heaven upon a country, But they thought that maybe within a few years the next generation will find a solution to this. But I think if you talk to any of the big Southern planters, they would have said, we will never give this up because we're just making too much money. And as Gary Wills points out, I mean, the North felt more and more threatened as the slave states expanded and the reach of the Three-Fifths Clause made them more and more powerful.
David, thanks very much.
Thank you.
We're going to wrap up, but I want to ask each of you and about each of your subjects, if you will, in this context. Henry Wincick, you say that George Washington did have an epiphany and freed his slaves at the end of his life, yet did a great deal throughout his life to perpetuate what came to be called the peculiar institution. As we look at both of the men a little bit more whole than perhaps we have before, what remains to admire?
Oh, a lot remains to admire. He founded the country. He established the presidency. Without him, that we wouldn't have had a constitution. We owe everything we have to him. But we've never faced squarely the issue of Washington and slavery. And oddly enough, when you really look at it closely, you find that Washington grew to hate slavery and saw its tremendous destructive power and looked for ways to throw it off. He knew that there would be no legislative attempt to outlaw slavery in his lifetime, but I think that he tried to go around this political impasse and use his prestige to find a way to begin an emancipation process. So this is a new perspective on Washington. But I think that even looking at seeing that in his favor, it puts the others in a much darker light. I think that both of our books show how profoundly the founding was corrupted by slavery.
Gary Wills, Jefferson was not so much a liberator, but perhaps philosopher of the Revolution. In a way, is that more damning still in terms of his attitude towards slavery?
Well, it's hard to say. If you look at what is admirable in him, he is, in terms of world history, the great teacher of religious freedom, of separation of church and state. That's an immense accomplishment. He was also the one who gave us a tradition in America of idealism and optimism and of national vision. The Federalists did not have that national vision. Whatever you think of the Jeffersonian Republicans, despite slavery, they did forge an ideal of a single nation. So, as I say, with all of the flaws, you still have to look at what we owe them. And we can't disown them. You know, it's not as if we were a very pure people who look back and think they were terrible. We've inherited a great deal of what was wrong with their world, and we haven't purged it yet. Lincoln has the right attitude in the second inaugural address when he says, slavery is the great national sin, which we all have to do penance for and undergo purgation from.
You also quote Ulysses S. Grant in his memoirs, nations like individuals are punished for their transgressions. We got our punishment in the most sanguinary and expensive war of modern times. So, anyway, thank you both very much for coming in. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Gary Wills joined us from the campus of Northwestern University in Evanston, Illinois. He's the author most recently of Negro President Jefferson and the Slave Power. And Gary Wincick is the author most recently of An Imperfect God, George Washington, His Slaves, and the Creation of America. He was with us from Charlottesville, Virginia.